In this hour of Focus 580, we will be talking with Elizabeth Gaffney. She is the author of a newly published novel, relatively new, came out officially the beginning of March. It is her first, and the book is titled Metropolis. It's published by Random House. It's a novel that is set in New York City in 1868, and it is a lot of things. It's a story about some of the history of New York at a time when the city was growing rapidly. It's a story in part about the immigrant experience, and it revolves around mostly around two characters, a man and a woman, a man who comes to the United States from Germany and a woman from Ireland, and about how they meet and fall in love. And it's a good story, and I think that you might well enjoy reading the book. You can head out to the bookstore and look for it, or as a matter of fact, if you call in this morning and make a pledge of $40 or more, we have six copies of the book, Metropolis, provided to us by Random House, and we really appreciate that. So that's another thing that we're doing just to try to get people to the phones and get them to make a pledge. Let me tell you just a little bit more about our guest, Elizabeth Gaffney. She now serves as advisory editor of the Paris Review and was an editor with the Paris Review for quite a long time. She is teaching writing now at New York University. She's also done some translating from the German and has contributed short fiction to a number of publications, the North American Review, the Colorado Review, the Brooklyn Review, and others. And she is the author of Metropolis. It's her first novel. As we talk, questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Elizabeth Gaffney, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
It's a pleasure to be with you, David.
We appreciate it. And I really want to tell you that I enjoyed reading Metropolis very much.
Thank you so much.
I thought it was quite good. Something about this period, New York City in the Gilded Age, seems to grab writers. And I don't know if it's because those writers also happen to be New Yorkers, and it's part of it is love for the city, or part of it may be just because it's a remarkably colorful time and full of very colorful people. What is it about New York at this time that so grabs you?
Well, for me, New York in the late 19th century is at a fascinating turning point in the city's history, and it's a turning point for the history of this whole country, I feel, when immigrant arrivals were increasing to such a point that Ellis Island, the main immigration port that we all know about, is about to be created because the overwhelming numbers are too big for any facilities that they had on Manhattan at that time. You're also getting the kinds of modern infrastructure that we recognize today in our cities and towns, paved streets, water, sewers, bridges. Buildings are starting to be made more of brick and stone and less of wood, and the city that New York was at that time hit about a million in 1870, and to me, it's the beginning of the birth of the city that I still live in and that I recognize. And that was a very interesting moment for me, a kind of a turning point or a coming of age moment for the city in its history, and I think indeed for the whole country. So that was the main reason I chose that time.
There are a number of events that you use as backdrop and weave into the story, actual events, things that actually did happen. Was there anything in particular that, as you were thinking about writing the book or what you would do, was there any particular event out of all of those things that caught your imagination and maybe was the thing that got you toward the idea of, yes, I wanted to do this story, and I want to set it at this time, and I want to deal with some of these kinds of ideas?
Well, there were probably three pivotal real events that concentrated my interest in New York City history and my idea that I wanted to tell a tale of an immigrant coming to this country and inventing himself while our country was reinventing itself. And those were, one, a discovery I came across that although water had been brought into New York City in the 1840s, they had failed to provide any adequate sewerage to take all that water away, and the city was having massive problems with flooding and diseases as a result of this. And there was a realization. I almost liken it to a kind of a moment of puberty or adolescence when a body is growing too big for itself, and the uncomfortableness and the unexpected surprises as one's physical self shifts. And the city finally realized, my God, we have to do something about this, and instituted a huge campaign of sewer building. And there's a whole subplot which takes place with people working in the sewers and some gangs and criminals that are using the sewers as getaways and hideouts. And that, I was fascinated with that underbelly of New York and that moment, which was almost like the city going through its growing pains, discovering what, in fact, it needed to be as big as it was. So that was one thing. Then when I was reading about that era when they were doing all that building and construction, I came across, quite serendipitously, a newspaper article in one of the illustrated weeklies of the day, which had everything from national and congressional politics to world events and, you know, wars that were going on abroad, but they also had a lot of kind of local color stories. And there was an illustrated picture of a fire that had taken place in New York in the middle of winter, and so the building that had burned down was in flames but covered with icicles, and a tiger had just leapt out of the top of this building, which was being used by P.T. Barnum as a menagerie for one of his early ventures before he really had the circus per se. And this tiger had escaped the burning building, leapt out of the fourth-story window, landed on Broadway, only to be shot by a policeman while it was running uptown. And I just saw this crazy engraving and thought how exotic New York had been back in those days, and that really captivated me. So that became one of the initial scenes in the book. Just, I happened to come across this news story, and I loved it. That created a setting, and in fact, a job for my protagonist. I put him, I made him a worker in that establishment of P.T. Burnham's, and had him land in that fire so he could see that event. And then the last thing that I was really writing towards was the construction of the Brooklyn Bridge, which has always been a part of my local landscape. I grew up in its shadow and still live there, and it was so pivotal to the expansion of New York at that time, and I knew I wanted to have someone who kind of started out working in the lower echelons and sewers, quite literally, under New York, and eventually struggled to find a better job for himself and ended up working on something that soars up beyond those sewers and into the sky, which was the Brooklyn Bridge, and it was the great engineering marvel of its day. So those three events were the biggest structural ideas that I had when I set out to write it. And from there, I just followed my imagination.
Our guest this morning is Elizabeth Gaffney. Her first novel is Metropolis. It was published in early March, and it's published by Random House. And it is set in New York City in the late 1860s and does tell some of these stories that she has touched on and centers around the experiences of a man and a man who comes to America from Germany and a woman who comes here from Ireland, who meet under interesting circumstances and develop this relationship. And it's a good story. So you might head out to the bookstore and look for it. And as I mentioned here, I can't ever get too far away from the fact that we're asking people to support the station with their dollars. If it sounds intriguing to you, we can make it possible for you to have a copy, a brand new hardcover copy of Metropolis. We have six that were provided to us by the nice folks at Random House, and we're offering the opportunity for people who call in this morning and make a pledge of $40 or more. You can have a copy of the book. So otherwise, you can head out to the bookstore and look for it. And questions are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. As you mentioned, the thing that sets the plot in motion is this fire at P.T. Barnum's place. And this is where your hero, a man who who has several names through the course of the novel, but who ends up as Frank Harris, interestingly enough, because he's actually German. He's one of these people who's come to the United States with dreams and hopes and aspirations, with some talent and ability, with not much money in his pocket, and really has to start at the bottom and gets a job working in this place and is lucky to survive. He is lucky to get out alive. He does not have anything to do with this fire, but ends up as the prime suspect. And so then a lot of the novel has to do with his is trying to avoid the authorities who would like to charge him with setting this fire, which, of course, he didn't have anything to do with. And his in the how he becomes involved in with a criminal gang, which perhaps we'll talk a little bit about, how he meets this Irish woman and is transformed from the German to the Irishman, which is one of the great sort of lines that runs through the story. I want to be very careful here not to give too much of the story away. I'm sure you would appreciate that. But one of the things that happens is he becomes involved with this gang, and the gang decides he could be useful to them, but they of course want to make sure that he's not picked up by the police. So they come upon this brilliant idea. They pair him up with this young woman who's sort of a con artist. And say to her, what we want you to do is we want you to teach this German guy to be Irish, which she does, and teaches him all about life in Ireland and teaches him to speak with a brogue and changes him, makes him into, even though maybe Dan in his heart of hearts, he's still German. She makes him into a passable Irishman, passable enough so that he manages to convince other people that he is, in fact, Irish. And I love that idea. And it's so hooks in so well with this idea that we have about America, that is this place that no matter where you come from, if you decide you want to be something else, you can do that.
Well, I think that's the reason that I came up with this rather fantastic conversion. I mean, of course, it might have been more logical and average to say that an immigrant becomes American, but the truth is he's operating in a fairly lower class Irish immigrant setting when that's the world that he gets thrust into. And so I believe that, you know, the immigrants assimilate into whatever community adopts them. And for him, he wasn't so much being brought into this American world as this kind of Irish subculture. And the Germans and the Irish were the two main immigrant groups to New York at that particular period. Later, Italian immigrants increase and, you know, the whole mix of people was already there, of course. But in terms of demographics and numbers, those were the big groups. So I wanted them both to be represented in some way. And I think really his shifting of names and identities and the play that I do with that in terms of his character and his attempt to reconstruct an identity for himself as a new person was for me just an example of the American experience. I wanted him to be a kind of an everyman so that he gets to try on more than one national identity in an odd way on his way to assimilating and becoming an American.
Hmm. I tell you, we have a caller here, someone who's on a cell phone, so I want to make sure we get them on our toll-free line. Line number 4. Hello.
Hi, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Yeah, hi, I'm enjoying the show, and since I am on the cell, I'll just make a couple of brief comments. Perhaps your guests can comment on them, and then I'll go ahead and hang up. I did want to say that I was lucky enough to call in and pledge and get a copy of the book, so I appreciate that, and I'm looking forward to reading it. It sounds wonderful. We were just in New York last weekend, my wife and our two small children. My 9-year-old had an audition for a Broadway play, so we hiked everybody up, flew to New York, and spent a weekend there, and it was just wonderful. We've been there a few times, but New York is so big. I'm from Chicago, and New York, you know, you could drop Chicago in New York and never find it again, and there's always, you know, so much to see, and it is, you know, it's an experience. You know, people have to be prepared for, you know, quite an urban experience, but it is something to see. My comments were just a couple, and then I'll hang up. One thing we found delightful was we took the kids to Trinity Church. And that was open to the public. And, of course, the dates, they escape me right now, but I think it was late 1600s or whatever when the church was built. And, of course, it's in the middle of Wall Street and it's these cavernous buildings, and it's just kind of hard to even visualize that. And then the actual name of Wall Street, of course, was built as a wall to keep the Indians out. And, again, if you're in New York and on Wall Street, you just can't even fathom that. But my two questions were with regards to the South Bronx. I keep wanting to go there to as a tourist, and the cab drivers keep telling me, no, you don't want to do this. But I was just relating whether or not that was close to geographically Five Points and or Hell's Kitchen, and was that all part and parcel of the same area? And has that area made any sort of a rebound, urban rebound, as far as, you know, re-gentrification and growth again? Or is it still a fairly blighted area? And anyway, if you want to comment on that, and I'm enjoying the conversation, so thanks a lot.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thanks for your call. The Five Points area is a lot closer to Wall Street. It was a small city even in the 1870s geographically, and one reason that it had the feeling of a big city to its inhabitants is that there were a million people, and they were living downtown. So what we consider now to be New York City includes Manhattan, Brooklyn, the Bronx, Queens, and Staten Island. And the South Bronx is pretty far north. The Five Points area was the big crime den, and that's where things were bad, where sort of, you know, the gangs of New York is a familiar setting, a familiar movie that takes place in that setting. And a lot of my book happens roughly in that area. Hell's Kitchen became a sort of a gangland in a little bit of a later era, and that's more midtown on the far west side, which really has been pretty well gentrified now. Not, you know, it's not the swishiest residential neighborhood, partly because you have Port Authority and some big sort of infrastructure over there that prevents it from being great residential. And the South Bronx, I think parts of it have come back a lot, but not nearly to the degree that other parts of the city have. And the city's been, it's not one of the most dangerous places to be these days. It's pretty well thriving, and the South Bronx still probably has a little further to go in terms of returning to prosperity than some of the other areas that have rebounded.
Okay. Well, I appreciate the call of the caller. I certainly appreciate the pledge. And we will continue here to talk with our guest, Elizabeth Gaffney, a native New Yorker who writes about New York in 1868 in her book, Metropolis. It's out now just recently, but not maybe a couple of months, published by Random House. For people, by the way, who are interested in the book, there is a website. She has a website. And one of the things that's kind of cool about the website is there is a map of New York City at this time with the locations that are mentioned in the story marked out. And there are some links on there. If you click on them, you can see some images from those places. So it's kind of fun. If you're really not that familiar with New York, with Manhattan particularly.
You can actually see that shot of the burning Barnum Museum and the tiger being shot by the policeman, too. If you click on the Barnum's American Museum link on the website, which one of the reasons I put it up was I was so excited by some of the research materials and images that I came across while writing the book. And since I couldn't convince Random House to bring it out as an illustrated volume, I thought I'd make them available somehow.
Well, it's really cool. It's cool, I must say. It's a nice thing to be able to have that, to see some of those images, because it, again, helps you to sort of get them fixed in your mind. Like, as you say, these images of the building, the burning building encased in ice because it was March and it was cold at the time. And it's a nice add-on to the book. Well, I tell you what, Elizabeth, we got to pause here for just a second to see if we can get people to give us some more money. And I do want to check and see how we're doing, because we did hear now just from one gentleman who said he was listening, and he called and he made a pledge. So he got one of the books. We started out with six, and I want to know how we're doing. So here in the studio with me is Jack Brighton.
Hello.
And Dave Teal, our program director for WILL-TV. He's in the Pledge Center. We have heard from some people this morning, Dave?
We have. We've actually had four calls during Focus 580 this morning, one who has taken us up on the book. And I do want to mention, you're talking about that map that's on the website. Well, that's also in the book. And so another way, if you want to take a good look at that, well, you can call us today and make a pledge at the $40 level or above, and we'll send you a copy of the book. And you know, keep in mind, this is a $25 book in hardcover, so it's a great bargain. Call us right now at 244-9455. We've still got five copies of the book to give away this morning, so you can do that. And also help us to meet a challenge for 15 pledges by the end of this hour. So we have about 33 minutes to go, 11 calls to get in. We really need to make some progress right now toward that challenge. And that's $250 on the line from a listener in Urbana who enjoys Focus 580. So $250, 11 calls to go. Call now, 244-9455. Last weekday morning of this pledge drive.
That's right. As David says, it is the last chance for fans of Focus 580 to make a pledge during this pledge drive. So please don't miss out on that. And don't miss out on getting this book, which we'll happily send your way with your pledge of $40 or more, 244-9455. We love giving away books.
We do.
Absolutely right.
If there's one thing we like,
yes,
it's writers,
yes,
and books and reading. And we do like to talk with writers on the show. We have a lot of authors. We've talked with some people who write fiction. We've talked with a lot of people who write about political issues, social issues, history, science, all kinds of things.
Absolutely.
And one of the great delights for me is that we have people send us books. The publishers send us books, make authors available. Mm-hmm. I get the opportunity to read about and learn about just about anything that catches my interest that I think will be interesting to people who are listening. So that is a great feature of doing this job that
absolutely
I get to take
right
advantage of.
You know, one of the other things about the show is that we also invite you to suggest authors and books and topics in general. It doesn't have to be a book. But it's one of the things about, I think, the station here in general is that we're very open to suggestions from the people who, you know, listen and participate in the conversations that we have here. We're very interested in your ideas about what we should do with the show. So, I mean, that's the kind of thing we do. And, you know, we appreciate your support. So we hope you'll go to the phone now. Now, 244-9455, make a pledge, get a free book. You know, people ask us, how do you, you know, you're giving away free books, how do you raise any money if you're giving free books away? And I think the answer is,
we don't pay anything for them.
Yeah.
Well, they're free.
That's true.
They're free to, no, seriously. I mean, we do get a lot of books. Publishers send them in the hope that we will interview their authors.
Yeah.
So they, I mean, we should be honest. Yes, they're free to us. And we would like to find homes for them. That's what we're really all about. They're, to have them sitting on here on our bookshelves, that's not going to do anybody any good. And we know that people will enjoy them, will learn things, will have a good time reading those books. Then maybe they'll pass them on to somebody else, and maybe they'll pass them on to somebody else, and a lot of people will read them. That's what we're really interested in doing. It's sort of a, you know, one of the ways that we have grabbed onto to try to get people jazzed about making a contribution, and some way that we can say, thanks, here, we think that you might enjoy this.
Okay. One other thing, and then I'll let you get back to the interview with the author here. We do have a challenge during Focus 580, and I don't know if we mentioned that during this break, but in addition to getting a copy of Metropolis with your $40 or more pledge, you also help us meet this challenge for Focus 580, and I believe it's someone has put $200 on the table if we hear from 15 people during Focus 580 this morning.
So, that's right.
So please make that pledge call, 217-244-9455.
Should we check with Dave Teal just one more time? I just want to make sure, Dave, how many people we've heard from so far on Focus today?
Well, we by the way, that challenge is for 250,
oh, thank
and
you.
We've gotten at least three calls in the last couple of minutes, so we're at least at 7 and I think possibly 8 right now toward the challenge. We need 15 calls, so we need to get everybody going. I believe we may still have a book left. I'm not sure.
Well, and you know, Dave, we got a message from Heather saying we can get more books.
Oh, okay, Heather. Yes,
we don't
right
have to draw the line at 6.
That's right. Well, yeah, and Harriet Williamson, our producer here, just nodded and said yes.
Okay,
we can get more books.
So, if you'd like to have a copy of Metropolis, we'll make it possible for you. At the same time, make a contribution at the $40 level or above. If more, that would be great. But 40 is all that's required, and we'll send you a copy of the book we're talking about here this morning. Well, thank you, guys. I want to get back here to our guest, Elizabeth Gaffney, thanks for your patience there, Elizabeth, as we did all that foolishness with asking people for money.
Well, I'm all behind raising money for public radio, believe me.
Very good. Our guest, Elizabeth Gaffney, is a former editor of the Paris Review. She teaches writing at New York University and is the author of Metropolis, her first novel published by Random House. Questions here, if people like to call in, that's certainly possible, as always. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. The novel is set, as I mentioned, it's set in the late 1860s. And if people saw Martin Scorsese's movie Gangs of New York, this is the time we're talking about. That might now resonate with some folks. And you do indeed highlight one gang in particular, a gang called the Wyos. And I guess the story is that this first of all, was an act. There was actually a real gang, such a gang.
Yeah.
And it was named for their way of calling out to one another.
Yes. There's an account that I've read that explains the name of the Wyo gang as being a kind of a onomatopoetic version of a call that they used to communicate with each other during robberies and other jobs so that they could pass secret signals without alerting their victims or nearby police or bystanders. And that idea of a secret language among criminals really resonated with me, and that was one of the main reasons, aside from the fact that this gang was active at the particular time I wanted to write about, that I decided to adopt them for my story. And a couple of the crimes and misdeeds and things that take place in the book are based on real incidents that I read news reports about in some of the local daily and weekly papers of the time. And a certain amount of it also remains pretty undocumented. Most of the criminal underworld's doings don't make it into the paper. And so I had a lot of fun inventing some of their other activities.
Well, it's a wonderful notion, this idea that you then take that as your jumping off point to this idea that of creating an entire kind of vocabulary that the gang develops to communicate. And that particularly it's the way that the leadership of the gang communicates with all of the members of the gang in a very, very detailed and complicated way that they have of communicating, not just with the gang generally, but even just with individual members of the gang.
Well, you know, the funny thing about it is that I didn't exactly invent this secret language I attributed to the gang. I got the idea of it when I happened to be on a family trip to Scotland, the first and only time I had ever been there, but it was wonderful. And one of the things we did was visited a sheep farm where the farmer gave us a demonstration of the way he worked with his sheepdogs. And he had about 24 dogs, and he had a number of puppies and was showing us how he trained them and explained that in order to perfectly manage a large herd of sheep, what they have is each dog trained separately with its own language of whistle codes so that you can tell, you know, the dog named Blackie to go out forward, stop and turn right, and then run back, and you're telling, you know, another dog whose name is Queenie to go off to the right. And in this way, you can sort of orchestrate the two flanks of dogs running around to very effectively herd your sheep. And this idea that his dogs, they had a few common vocabulary words so that all the dogs would know to stop or sit or come back at a certain point. But the main communication that he had with these dogs was on an individual basis. So he would work with each dog alone to train them on their own whistle patterns so he could control each dog separately. And the complexity of it, I mean, it reminded me, I don't know, it was, I mean, some kind of elaborate military strategy, and I was just fascinated. And, you know, it was sometime later that I came to the section of my book where I became interested in this gang with a secret language, and I thought somehow of those sheepdogs and how fascinating that would be. The gangsters could have their own way of communicating with each other. So I borrowed in a way that sheepdog whistle pattern code. And when we were listening to the farmer work his dogs, it was an elaborate song because he was continuously playing different whistle patterns, talking to all 24 dogs in sequence. And so he never stopped whistling, and the dogs were only responding to the commands that they knew. It was just fascinating to me. So that was the inspiration for it, as well as perhaps a few pieces of advice that my father gave to me as a young girl growing up in Brooklyn, New York. I remember he told me that when I was walking, especially on the street in the evening, especially if I was alone, that I should always know who else was on the block with me, and I should listen carefully, and if I ever heard any unusual noises or sounds, because there he had this idea that gangs communicated with each other, and you might get locked into an ambush or a mugging, two people working on either side of the street or coming out of a cul-de-sac or around a corner. And so I think I must have had an anxiety about how one could be ambushed through the secret language used by criminals implanted in me, and it's made me, knock on wood, pretty street savvy, and I haven't been mugged yet. But when it came time to inventing the gangsters for this book, all those things came into it.
Yeah. Oh, it's a wonderful idea, and I like the fact that one of the things that one of your lead characters, Frank Harris, comes to realize is that he starts to learn how to listen. And he starts hearing things that if you know how to listen, they are there. And that sort of the idea that for the rest of us, people are just going about their business and not really paying attention. They don't hear those things. But if you start to know what to listen for, there's all kinds of stuff going on in the world around you. And in this particular case, part of it was this unique language that this criminal gang had to communicate with one another.
Yeah, I do think that it's one of the features of living. I mean, in the city, it's the ambient noise is, you know, there could be planes flying overhead and trucks on several blocks over and construction and all kinds of things going on. And you know, depending on what your environment is, I think there are always noises that tell you what the weather is or what people are doing, working, what animals are out there. And I'm very interested in perceiving the world not just through sight or, you know, the most commonly used senses, but smells, which play a big role in the book, too, because New York was such a dirty, smelly place in those days. And the sounds of the city were fascinating to me, so I tried to put them in there.
Mm-hmm. There's something else, another feature of this gang, the Wyos, that's kind of interesting, and that is that they have a profit-sharing plan.
Yes.
Was that something that you just made up yourself, or is there some basis for that idea at having actually been in practice?
Well, it wasn't this gang per se that had that, but I did come across any number of accounts of fascinating utopian visions that people had in this period in the late 19th century. You know, it's not that far after the time in Europe of the Paris Commune. People are, you know, there were free love societies that, you know, in upstate New York where people decided that peace and harmony could be achieved through open marriages and communal raising of children. People were experimenting with early forms of communism. People had all these crazy ideas, and I think we've forgotten that because most utopian visions fail dismally, as we know. And I thought it would be an interesting thing to plug into both the good characters who are living on the up and up and part of society in New York, as well as these underworld criminals that, you know, everyone to some extent dreams of a better life and has some sort of notion. And profit-sharing ideas were very much in the air at that time, and people had, you know, started factories where workers were enfranchised in that way, and I wanted the gang to have its good side. They're a very dirty, nasty, murderous gang, and in the end, this this sort of profit-sharing notion doesn't turn out to be so fabulous, but I suppose they're just a little bit better than some of their counterparts who were the gang leader was robbing every gangster while every gangster was robbing every innocent citizen, and everyone's just as bad as they can be. I wanted them to have a redeeming quality.
Yeah. Well, I think, again, one of the clever things that the leadership of this gang did was they were interested in they knew that the police were aware of them, but they wanted to make sure that the police thought that they were nothing really special. They were nothing big. They were nothing important. They were low-level nuisance criminals, and they were never going to do anything really big. And that actually provided them with cover to do a lot of very ambitious criminal activities. But always, they just seemed to be always flying just the tiniest bit under the radar, never wanting to do anything so flashy that would attract the attention of the authorities.
Well, I have this philosophy of hiding in plain sight, which I think is a successful one in the world. And it seems to me that so many times people who are trying to pull something off fall on their own sword because they're caught bragging about it or too pleased with their own success to conceal it. And The other success strategy of this gang is exactly what you described, to basically behave like a bunch of minor league ruffians, and even when they do a grand job and get a lot of money, they don't go around bragging about it. Nobody knows about it. They try to make it look like some other gang has actually done the job. They're working with a kind of a camouflage principle of criminality, and to a certain extent, it works for them.
Hmm. We have talked a little bit about the main male protagonist, the man who comes from Germany and eventually becomes the American Frank Harris. We haven't really talked about his counterpart in this story, this Irish woman who mentioned the fact that there was this gang, the Wyos, that actually was a real gang. And what you do is you invent a ladies' auxiliary called the Why Nots, which is pretty good. The Why Nots that are a very tough bunch of women who are the wives and girlfriends of the men who are in the Wyos. And this one woman in particular becomes very important in the story and how her relationship with the German man develops. But tell us a little bit about that character.
Well, she starts off as just kind of your average pickpocket in this girl gang that's associated with the gang. And I might just add that there was not a gang called the Why Nots in New York at that time, but there was a tradition of girl gangs associated with criminal gangs. And there's a famous gang of the approximately that era called the 40 Thieves, and they had a girl gang called the 40 Little Thieves. And on that inspiration, and because although my main character is a man, it was clear to me that there were going to be a lot of strong women characters in this book, and I decided that I wanted the Y's to have their corollary. What happens is she's smart and is very successful, even though she doesn't have a powerful role in the gang, and ends up rising to a position where she's sought after by the gang leader, and he wants her to be his main girl. At the same time, the love interest between our main character, who's not a criminal at heart and kind of stuck in this terrible situation where he's become one by circumstance and bad luck, and a little bit of a weak character problem that he has, they're becoming increasingly embroiled, just as she's becoming such an effective gangster that the boss wants her to be his girlfriend. So hence a rather deadly love triangle ensues.
I'm so intrigued by this gang, and obviously you were inspired by, as was Scorsese, and I imagine probably a lot of other writers, by this classic book, The Gangs of New York, which is perhaps in some sense not completely factual, but is an account of the criminal gangs at this time in New York City. And a book that I guess I don't recall when that book was first published. Was it in the 20s?
I think it was the 30s. I don't remember the exact publication date, but, you know, it definitely takes you into Prohibition era gangsters. So the thing about Herbert Asbury's book, The Gangs of New York, is that it's a history, a kind of a folk history with a certain amount of apocrypha and, tall tales added into facts. But what it does is it surveys a kind of an informal history of great underworld characters and gangs and crimes that took place from the early days of New York through to the Prohibition era. And so you get stories from every era and every time period of the city's history. And he arranges it in chapters and divides it into sections, sometimes by gang or gangster or sometimes by whatever era and what was going on in the city at that time. And Scorsese's movie picks up a different set of gangsters than I did, but I too came across a narrative in that book which concerned the Wyos, which really captivated me. And there were a couple of things. One, there's a series of mugshots that Herbert Asbury's book reproduces of 19th century early photographs when they first started making mugshots. And there was a guy named Piker Ryan who was a Wyo. And among his crimes were he was arrested after a murder with a sheet of paper on his person which listed different crimes that he would commit and how much he would charge for them. And the one that totally amused me, I mean, you could break a man's leg or kill a man or this or that, but one of the crimes he was advertising and had, I think it cost about $5 for man's ear chawed off. And the picture of this guy, he looks like the stupidest lout you have ever seen. I mean, he is just terrifyingly thuggish, and he was somehow so awful and so funny. I picked him up as a side character in the book because I just thought that was terrific, and terrible, but somehow comic. And then there's a murder that takes place that one of the gang leaders, a guy named Johnny Dolan, actually committed in around 1873, I think it was, and was tried for murder and actually got caught. So that murder came into the real history. Comes from the real history and makes it into my book as well as a plot point towards the end. I was really inspired by Herbert Asbury's descriptions of, he just picked up the color of these gangsters and included all the right details. And it's interesting why people are so fascinated with the history of crime. It's probably the same reason we tell ghost stories and like to watch scary movies. But I think people want to understand what makes people do dastardly deeds. Yeah. And so some of that comes into my book.
Well, and I suppose, too, is because some of the characters are so impossibly, improbably colorful and yet are real. And there's some appeal there, too, I suppose, because you do find characters again, if as a writer you made them up, somebody might say, "Oh well, that's a little over the line, don't you think?" But there, in fact, are real people whose lives were very much like that, and there's something perversely attractive maybe about that.
Well, I think some of the most improbable events that take place in my novel are definitely the real ones that came from whether newspaper reports or a crazy thing that happened that's described in that Gangs of New York folk history. And one of the challenges that I had was, you know, I was so amazed something like that might have happened. I wanted to imagine a world in which I could try to make it plausible. And that was part of the fun of it for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I'm interested in, as you're thinking about being, it is, after all, a modern book, and you are a modern writer, but it's an historical novel, and it is set in New York City in 1868. So you want to be faithful to, as much as you can, to the details of the period and what life then would have been like. And as you said, there are a number of events that you include in the story that are things that actually happened. There was actually a man working on the Brooklyn Bridge who fell and lived to tell the story. So that there are things like that that maybe sound like they could have been made up that weren't. How do you, as a writer approaching the story with a modern sensibility, being a person of 2005, weigh up wanting to tell a story that people now will resonate with, and yet in a number of ways you want to be faithful to the spirit of the time that you're writing about?
Well, it's an interesting line to walk, and I think there are different schools of historical fiction. There are some that are terribly accurate and, histories that are almost, novels that are almost histories or biographies and follow the true life events of one famous person. And there's a great history of other kinds of historical novels that delve into the fantastical or bridge modern times and sensibilities with historical events. And, I mean, I'm thinking of books like Mark Halperin's Winter's Tale or Martin Dressler, Michael Chabon's Amazing Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, a little bit later era in New York. But I tried to allow the factual, historical, and the slightly fantastical to merge a little bit, because, after all, I think people are reading novels to be entertained and to be taken away from their world. At the same time, you don't want to feel like you're being led astray or being given false information, and one of the ways I handled that was by having there be a quite contemporary 21st century narrative voice that is involved in telling my story. So there are times when one of the themes that I was very interested in was the sort of state of medicine and science in that turn of the century, or I guess I should say sort of fin de siècle, 19th century world. They were just discovering germs and microbes, and they didn't have antibiotics or anything like that. But I allow my narrator to comment on genetic makeup and diseases that hadn't by any means been identified by their microbes and bacteria. And I wanted there to be a sense that this was not an old-fashioned book, but a 21st century novel that takes place in the past. And it was a lot of fun to try to strike a balance there.
Well, I enjoyed it a lot, and I want to thank you very much for giving us some of your time to talk about it. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me on the show. It was a pleasure, and I hope all your listeners will call in and pledge.
We hope so, too. Our guest, Elizabeth Gaffney, she's former editor of the Paris Review. She teaches now writing at NYU. The book is Metropolis, her first novel. It's published by Random House.